Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, we're examining the current state of academic foodways, a discipline that barely existed 25 years ago. Food writer Brett Anderson is back from his Nieman Fellowship at Harvard. We'll talk with Brett about how that year of study changed him both personally and professionally. Then, University of Austin Professor Elizabeth Engelhardt reflects on the ways food tells the story of race, class, gender, and social power across the South. We study foodways and have some food fun, too, on this week's Louisiana Eats. If you've ever read a Times-Picayune restaurant review, then you're familiar with food critic Brett Anderson. His reviews began running in 2001, and since then, Brett's had his finger on the pulse of Louisiana's restaurant scene. But that's not where he started. Brett originally worked as a rock reporter in Minneapolis, then switched over to the food beat just in time to see it embraced by the mainstream. During his relatively brief career, he's experienced firsthand the shifting landscape of food media.
I guess I always have been open to the idea that maybe there might be some other part of journalism that would open up to me and I would start writing about something else. And in some ways, I still think that, you know, I still get up every day because one of the things that attracted me to newspapers in the first place was that growing up and reading the newspaper, I was sort of taken by all the different things in it. And that was one of the reasons I was drawn to newspapers in the first place, was because I kind of had general interests. There's always a part of me that is open to writing about different topics. With each passing year, I become less interested in leaving this beat. You know, the longer I do it, the more it seems I'll stay doing it, because food is just never – it hasn't stopped being interesting to me. The more I travel and the older I get and the more I eat out in restaurants, the more I sort of appreciate them for being the places where the stories of cities reside. And my real interest in journalism, which started as a music writer, you know, I grew up in the suburbs outside Minneapolis, and I was really drawn into the city of Minneapolis through punk rock. And what fascinated me as much as the music was sort of the culture around it, the grit, the urban environment that surrounded and still surrounds a lot of the sort of pop music and underground rock and roll culture. And while restaurants sort of lack some of that grit, they still do allow me access to what it is that sort of most interests me and has interested me about our culture, and that tends to be urban. And so those things I don't think are ever going to exhaust themselves in terms of the interest that they provide me and hopefully readers.
Well, I'd like to talk about how over the course of your career, can you describe how you personally have seen food media evolve?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly grown in the sense that food and restaurants have risen to such a place of prominence within our culture. Mm-hmm. When I started, I'm 43 years old. I got my first restaurant column when I was 25, and so it's almost half of my life. And when I started, there wasn't a big cable presence for chefs and for food on television in the way it is today. It was pre-Emeril Lagasse. It was pre the sort of celebrity chef era. So as a field, as a beat, it's gone from the fringe to becoming as mainstream as covering rock and roll, really. So that's a huge change.
It is. It is. Actually, during that time period, chefs became rock stars.
Yeah.
So that's
a really good analogy.
Yeah.
People say that. And its rise was about as quick. I mean, I think there's a parallel to rock and roll's rise in some ways. You know, it's not an entirely tidy comparison, but it was quick and it is has become very dominant.
Well, Brett, 25 years ago, there was really hardly the internet.
When I started, there wasn't.
You know, it was all print. Everything was paper that you picked up. So that's a pretty huge change right there.
Yeah, that's not one I mentioned yet. But yeah, of course. And it's definitely changed the way that journalists cover food and cover restaurants. And it's changed the way that I think restaurant critics work in ways that haven't totally resolved themselves yet. You know, I think it still remains to be seen how restaurant critics will operate.
Well, do you think that restaurant critics as a category are disappearing and that it's turning just more into like chat?
Yes. I mean, I think there's no doubt that they're disappearing, partly because, you know, restaurant criticism rose out of the daily newspaper world when daily newspapers were monopoly businesses in terms of their audiences in most markets and were awash in money. It was an interesting thing to do with your budget. It served an audience of affluent and aspirant readership. And as we all know, here in New Orleans in particular, the daily newspaper business has changed drastically.
It sure has.
And, you know, you see less people doing restaurant criticism in the way that you did in the past, where it's you write one column a week, you eat out all the time. That's not really the way anyone does the job anymore.
Well, actually, that's something I wanted to ask you about, because once upon a time, food writing and critiquing restaurants was really the only thing you were doing at the Times-Picayune. Mm-hmm. And so I know that that is far from your job description now. So kind of walk us through the other things that are expected of you in your position at the TP.
Well, I guess the simple way to put it is that, you know, I write restaurant reviews and I write feature stories. Those feature stories can take a variety of different forms. They can be 200-word blog posts. They can be 1,200-word interviews, profiles, trend stories, these kinds of things. As to what my job description is right now, I'd say that it's evolving. You know, I mean, when I can return to New Orleans, we have actually at the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com a bigger staff than we've ever had before covering restaurants. Todd Price has come aboard and handles really all the news part of the beat, of the restaurant beat. And, you know, we're experimenting with different ideas on how to incorporate video into our coverage and how to make frequency, you know, frequency of delivering information, how to make that make sense and still make it intelligent coverage. You know, and I just got back in the fall, and immediately when I got back, I wrote a dining guide, and then it was Christmas break and here I am. You know, so it's still an evolving job description, I'd say. But our goal is to try to serve an audience that knows and a lot about restaurants, a discriminating food and dining audience with coverage that sort of treats them with respect intellectually and suits their needs in terms of what they want to know about restaurants, what they want to be entertained by in terms of that coverage.
So despite the rapidly disappearing print scene, food media continues to grow. Perhaps the Harvard Committee of the Nieman Foundation of Journalism knew this when they selected Brett to be one of their fellows in 2012. They made a good choice. Brett spent a year in Massachusetts reflecting on his career as a journalist. For the first time in a long time, food did not have to be Brett's focus. But as he learned, it's hard to say goodbye to something so closely tied to your heart. Tell us about the general food studies scene at Harvard. What was that like?
Well, it's interesting you ask. You know, the food studies as a discipline is, as you know, very much a burgeoning and growing field of study in the academic world. At Harvard specifically, that isn't necessarily the case, which isn't to say that there isn't, you know, there aren't classes that someone who's interested in food could take. But it does not have a food studies department, for instance.
Oh.
And a lot of the studying that I did while I was there had less to do with food in particular and more to do with issues that have interested me in my work that surround food.
Give us some examples. So what were you studying?
Well, I mean, the only food class I took is something called Science and Cooking, which is one of the most popular classes at Harvard. It's basically it's a chemistry class, really, and they bring in very prominent chefs every single week, a different one that sort of guides the discussion. You know, in crude terms, it's a way to get kids to take chemistry.
Yeah,
by making it really fun. And the fact that that class was so popular was probably the thing that was most interesting to me. I mean, I am not a science person, and it was a very technical science class, but it was interesting to watch the phenomenon around it. It's not to say I wasn't engaged by the material in it, but as a journalist, that was probably the most interesting part of it.
You really wanted to interview your fellow students.
I very much did, yeah, which is not encouraged. All of that was unexpected to me. You know, when you go to take one of these fellowships, as I now know, it's hard to predict exactly where your time is going to go, what your interests are going to draw you to.
What sticks with you as some of your big aha moments and all that? When did you're in a history course and something in your brain about the restaurant scene opens up?
That's a good question. The one sort of general thing that I think pertains to what we're talking about today that was a eureka is that I like thinking about eating. I like thinking about restaurants, and I like thinking about New Orleans, and I like to think about the connections between all that and what one means to the other. I consider myself really privileged to be able to do that for a living, and I was reminded of that even while I was doing something that was equally maybe more privileged, and that was to, you know, take time away from all that to, you know, to read Moby Dick and John Dos Passos and a lot of history and a lot of old journalism.
Before we totally leave Harvard, I'm really curious because I know that you are very involved and you have been for years and years with the Southern Foodways Alliance, which is based at Ole Miss in Oxford. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the Southern Foodways Alliance and the work that goes on at Ole Miss, I guess you've already kind of answered the question about how it stacks up against Harvard.
The Southern Foodways Alliance lives within the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at Ole Miss, and that's a very unique and special place. And, you know, Harvard is in New England. they don't have a Center for the Study of Southern Culture. And so in that way, it is sort of incomparable, and I think the Southern Foodways Alliance is a very singular institution. But one thing that wasn't as surprising to me in the year I went away to Harvard, in some degree because of my involvement with the Southern Foodways Alliance, I think there is natural connection between the work of academics and the work of journalists, and that is to get at some truth. And I felt a real affinity with the people in that world, even if they didn't feel it with me. You know, I could see the connection between what our interests were.
And isn't it kind of interesting now that you've spent that time up there that perhaps one of the things that the Slow South seems to be excelling in is food studies.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's amazing.
And there is, you know, I should say that at Harvard they do have a great collection at Radcliffe College, a culinary cookbook and culinary literature collection. And, you know, NYU has a very good food studies program. But I think that's accurate. There is a lot of great scholarship surrounding food in the South.
Well, I know we're living in the right place. That was Brett Anderson, restaurant critic and food writer for the Times-Picayune. How can tomato seeds change a girl's life? When we come back from the next short break, Professor Elizabeth Engelhart shares the story of an amazing project began over a century ago, the Girls Tomato Club. Stay tuned.
Lord, have mercy.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. People have passed on their knowledge of agriculture, nutrition, and culinary arts for centuries, if not millennia. Although we studied food scientifically, it wasn't until the latter half of the 20th century that academics started looking at food from a humanitarian perspective. Professor Elizabeth Engelhardt is one of those people. Among other things, she teaches women and gender studies at the University of Texas in Austin and co-edited the Larder, Food Study Methods from the South. Elizabeth recently spoke with us about her work in food studies and how she first got involved in the discipline.
I was doing a project on the mountains of North Carolina, and I was talking about environmentalism there. I was talking about women's novels, and I was spending a lot of time in the archives, and I was spending a lot of time thinking about what had really changed between the 1880s and today. And as I was doing that research, I kept running across people talking about what they were eating, what they wished they were eating, and what they thought other people should either start or stop eating. And it occurred to me that that story of food would be a way to really talk about the U.S. South, to talk about what brings us together, what's kept us apart, and what we remember and why that's the case. Then pretty soon after that, I got involved with the Southern Foodways Alliance, and I realized that, indeed, I was not at all working alone. There were a lot of people who were deeply interested in talking to people, in going to the archives, in looking at our history, our literature, our journalists, our food producers, our practitioners, and figuring out what that could tell us about who we are and where we've been and what we eat. And so, seeing a good thing, I ended up really devoting myself to this emerging field.
You were so lucky to be in the perfect place at the perfect time.
Well, that's right, and particularly in terms of food studies in the humanities. So using food to talk about culture, to talk about those questions of race and class and gender. Sometimes I'm starting from my own experience or from my family's experience, and I'm asking questions about what that means, how it's different from other groups, other families. I'm originally from Appalachia, so it's part of the South, but it's a part of the South that isn't always connected, isn't always counted. And so it gives me a way to say what's in common with other parts of this place, what's different. But then sometimes I start in the archives, and I'm interested in how have people remembered things, what do they use when they make the recipes, when they try to do something with that food, but also who do they give it to, who do they not, how do we get to those questions of race and class and gender. And what I find is that those two strategies come together a lot of times. And so I'll find my family or someone like my family in those archives. I'll find archives hidden in a friend's mother's recipe collection. For me, it's just a question of trying to be open to all of these stories, not walking into it with any preconceived ideas about what our food means, but being willing to ask questions.
You grew up in Appalachia. How did your journey to the place you're in and the work you do today begin?
So my mother's family ended up in Western North Carolina by about 1790. And I think they fell in love with the mountains because they just never left. But I also have a father who's from Wisconsin. And my dad came to Western North Carolina also because he loved those mountains, but also because he was following his career as an engineer. And so I always had a perspective on where I was living that was both insider and outsider. Nobody fit perfectly. Everyone in my family was a little bit in, a little bit out. What does this mean? I think I felt that way in terms of food also. I learned from my grandmother how to make biscuits. I learned how to make her fried chicken. But I also, when I was told in sixth grade that I needed to make those two things for the school picnic, for the boys to auction off the girls' baskets, I was cranky about it. I thought, well, why aren't they cooking? Why don't I get to bid on someone's basket? What does that mean? So even in that situation, I absolutely loved the food and I loved what it meant to learn from my grandmother. But I wanted to know, why do we have these ideas about what's appropriate for girls to do and what's appropriate for boys to do?
When it comes to food, how do you think that those ideas have been formulated? How has that happened?
You know, food is such a daily experience. And our lives as men, as women, as people of different races, as people from different places, as people from different religions, all of that is a daily experience too. So that the two things come together and that you can use one to find out some things about the other makes sense to me. How it happens, how we put so much meaning into food, how we change that over time, I don't have the answer to that, but I love to look for it. And I love to keep asking questions about it because I think that is how we can talk about these issues that often as a society are really tough to talk about. It's tough to talk about what makes us different in terms of our ethnicity, what makes us different in terms of gender, how power works in society. But if I talk to you about why this food was available to you and why this food wasn't available to me, then we might be able to have that conversation about class, about race, about gender.
In the United States, I think so often the South gets pointed to as, the slow South, the place where everything happens last, behind the curve. Why do you think that in the South, Foodways has transcended that and we're the leader?
It's a really hard question, and it's a question I think about all the time. One thing that I think is important is that people in the South, when they had very little else, could nonetheless put together a meal. Sometimes that meal didn't have enough nutrition in it, wasn't enough to really break even, but you could still share a meal and you could still talk to each other over that meal. I think that we held on to our traditions of producing food. We held on to a lot of farming, sometimes out of just sheer necessity. But because that work was there, because that tradition was there, then we still had these practices very much to hand. I'm trying to answer the question very carefully, though, because there's a whole lot of people who don't feel included in that we. And I think that's one of the real challenges of talking about the U.S. South. But I think it's a challenge that we have to respect because goodness knows this part of the country has made it very hard for a lot of people to feel included over a long time. However, it's also a place where a lot of people have always lived. And food can be a way that we can figure out what those experiences were, connect to each other, figure out how we've been unable to connect in the past. And that's the place where I'm really optimistic about studying food.
That was Elizabeth Engelhardt, board member of the Southern Foodways Alliance and professor at the University of Texas. As you now know, Elizabeth's work has given her a comprehensive understanding of race relations, gender, and social class within the South. We couldn't resist teasing more interesting tales out of Elizabeth. By researching biscuits and cornbread, Elizabeth learned that the adage, "You are what you eat," was incredibly important in the reconstructed South.
If you chose to cook cornbread, you were judged to be one kind of family. And if you chose to cook a particular kind of biscuits, you were judged to be a different kind of family. And those judgments had to do with whether you were seen to be modern and hygienic and forward-looking, or whether you were backward and a little bit dirty and a little bit immoral. And I got fascinated with how that could be. And so then it turned out, as you dug down deeper into that story, some of the ways that judgment was being made was based on ideas of labor, who cooked in the kitchen, whether you did it yourself, whether you could hire someone to do it. It had to do with ideas of leisure, whether you were comfortable enough in terms of money to be able to stay indoors, for instance, rather than having to make something really fast after coming in from what other jobs you were doing. And so it became a story not only of class, but also of race, and absolutely of gender, because it was certain women telling other women which of those recipes they ought to fix. And I think in the U.S. South, particularly after the Civil War and as we were moving into the 20th century, questions of food, who was going to cook it, who was going to get paid to cook it, how it was going to change, were really high-stakes questions. And I also think that somewhere in that mix, there are some stories of how people connect across those foods. And that is also interesting. So that there are stories of what people did share and what happened in those kitchens, sometimes very charming, wonderful stories that we can go back and find and be inspired by, sometimes stories of violence or lack or loss. But in those moments, there were conversations happening. And that tells us something as historians, but also as eaters and as family members, and what we want to do as we walk around in the South today, which is still a place where those questions of race, those questions of change are very much in front of us.
So does that mean the more things change, the more they stay the same? Perhaps the answer comes from another story about women using the free market bulletins across the South. Think of them as an old school Craigslist during the 1920s.
So most of the states across the South, once their state agriculture departments got well established, decided that they ought to publish some bulletins free to farmers across the state. And the idea of those bulletins was that, well, this will be a place where people can exchange things that would otherwise be hard to sell or that would not, that you couldn't necessarily get just by going down to the corner store. Very early on, you start to see women using these market bulletins, especially the ads section, to form what eventually becomes really robust communities, oftentimes between people who never met each other. So you start to see advertisements for vegetables, for fruits, and for just simply beautiful flowering plants. And in those advertisements, you start to see people saying what they want, why they want them, what their hopes and dreams are for those things. And I came across a garden writer in North Carolina who, because her friend Eudora Welty gave her a subscription to one of the market bulletins, fell in love with these columns. So the garden writer's name was Elizabeth Lawrence. And she started answering all of the for sale ads. And she just started collecting the letters that she got in reply. And what happens when you look in the letters is you see that the correspondence becomes quickly very profound. People are talking about why they want that particular flowering plant. And then more than that, you start to see people say, well, I don't necessarily have that orchid. I don't necessarily have that lady slipper, but I have a friend who does, and maybe you should write to that friend. And so I became fascinated because you can trace these spider webs of connections across places that, you know, may not even exist today, that were just miracles of our rural mail system. And I think it's just another example of the way the foods that we have here in this place can connect us to each other.
I was particularly fascinated when you pointed out that it was very likely that these correspondences were sometimes passing between women of different races who didn't even ever know.
Well, that's exactly right. People didn't know if that address was on the wrong side of the tracks. They didn't know if it was the richest house up on the hill. Suddenly, when you have a correspondent who is from far away, you feel free to talk about things that really mean a lot to you, but that you might not be able to talk about in your town.
One of the things that most singularly delights me about food is its ability to bring together people whose worlds might not normally intersect. And when it becomes a means for economic independence, food can actually empower. In this last story, Elizabeth shares the tale of the Girls' Tomato Club.
In the turn of the century South, around 1909 to 1917 or 18, there was a movement that eventually involved 500,000 girls a year. So a very large movement, which encouraged girls to plant a tenth of an acre of tomatoes, harvest those tomatoes, can those tomatoes, learn the newest technology and how you do the canning, and then they learned how to market them, and then they learned how to brand them, and then they learned how to sell them. And it was a phenomenal movement because, unlike most of the efforts at that time, which could be very preachy, the Girls' Tomato Clubs were very different. The organizers generally said, there's your money. Do what you want to with it. If you want to buy a knife, go buy a big knife. If you want to buy a dress, that's great. Go get a dress. If you'd like to save it for your education, that would be terrific. If you want to think about how you can turn this into a career, we'll help you do that. What's also really fascinating about the Girls' Tomato Clubs was that in order to fully participate in the club, at the end of your harvest season, you had to write a report. And so as an archival researcher, that's what gets really exciting because it can be very hard to find voices of girls, and the girls were generally from about age 9 to age 17 or 18. Those are very hard voices to find from 100 years ago. What did they think? What did they find funny? What were they challenged by? What were they excited by? And in those Girls' Tomato Club reports, you get little hints of that. Some of them write poems. Some of them are budding chemists, and they're telling you exactly how many seconds and exactly how to balance the acidity and exactly how to think about canning. Others are clearly budding businesswomen, and they are planning their attack. Here's how I'm going to make this much money this year, this much money next year. I find the story of the club fascinating because you get that real connection between where we are today and where those girls were then.
And were the clubs themselves integrated as well?
It's very different in different states. Generally, they're not in terms of the girls. So the girls' clubs themselves are generally divided by race, although who knows what's hiding in the archives. There may be one or two stories that are a little bit different. But in a state like North Carolina, the adult women very quickly say, this is ridiculous to travel to these counties separately. It's ridiculous to do these training sessions separately. And so they, quite early on, integrate their training sessions. So the women who are overseeing the clubs are in these kind of integrated groups, talking together, writing letters to each other, telling each other about the colds that they have, the successes that they've had, the they get a flat tire and somebody has to help them out. And it's a very kind of human exchange between people at a moment where you don't always see that.
That was Elizabeth Engelhart, professor of American Studies at the University of Texas. Her most recent book, The Larder, Food Studies Methods from the South. It is possible to find a flavorful tomato year-round now, thanks to the proliferation of local greenhouses. How can you make sure that tomato keeps its taste once you take it home? Stay tuned. We'll solve that tomato quandary when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is the best way to keep a fresh tomato flavorful once you bring it home? Don't ever put it in the refrigerator. Fresh tomatoes must be kept at room temperature until consumed. Refrigerating a tomato changes its texture, but it also puts it into a state of hibernation, diminishing its natural sugars. your local farmer works hard to deliver that tasty tomato, so please give it the care and respect it deserves. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Although she worked for heavyweight news outlets like Newsweek and the New York Times during their heyday, Corey Brown knew the future of media was online. In 2009, she co-founded Zester Daily, a website for food enthusiasts that I've called the thinking man's source for food content.
Zester had a very humble beginnings. I knew that I wanted to have an online presence and I wanted to be publishing online. I did not want to be a blogger. I'm not somebody who gets up in the morning and wants to share my thoughts on my evening meal. I'm a journalist. I write stories. So I thought, who else out there is in the same position? Let's pool our resources and create a – we're a collective. We're a journalism collective. And it started out with a dozen, and we're now up to more than 50 writers around the world. The writers write what they know best. They write what they want to write. They write with authority because these are the subjects that most interest them. Nobody gets an assignment. And you would think there'd be all this overlap with 50 writers. It is so not the truth. Everyone is writing completely interesting, innovative stories driven by their own curiosity.
Why is the soapbox feature an important part of Zester?
The soapbox is where we bring in outside voices, authors, activists, politicians, people with opinions, and we help them to bring those opinions to our readers, and often they are controversial, always provocative, but we are not an activist publication. Our soapbox writers write from every point of view. We've had people take on Michael Pollan. We've had people write about technique in the kitchen that they, you know, you should all be cooking in parchment. It's much more efficient. It's all over the place. And no matter what day you come and look at our site, there will be an opinion that is not like the one that was there the week before and won't be like the one that's there the next week.
I'm very curious to understand because, you know, you mentioned the blogging thing, and I would like if you could explain to us how an online publication creates income.
It's the big challenge, and it's what I spend all my time working on. I wish I were just writing. That would be more fun. We are a shared revenue, shared equity site. If anyone ever makes a dime on the site, everyone shares in it. We are a true collective. It's a cooperative if I'm talking to my conservative friends. You know, there's marketing partnerships that we've developed. We syndicate. We resell the content to other publications, and that money goes directly to writers and, you know, the split between the writers and the site. So there is a – just by definition of who our writers are, we tend to be a little more ambitious in our stories selection than most food sites. You won't find five meals for $5 in 5 minutes. It's not that we wouldn't publish it. It's just that our writers are following their own interests, and nobody really wants to write that. They want to write about innovative new recipes coming out of chefs in Norway, or they want to write about ancient techniques that, you know, were popular in the medieval day that, you know, are applicable. You know, they are all over the place. So we believe that the world needs and wants high quality content, excellent reporting, and great writing. And we're banking that that's a business.
What do you see for the future of the written word?
I think we're going to read the written word, but we're not going to read it on paper. I'm moving to the iPad because I can curl up with an iPad. I can't really curl up with my computer. I like the photography. You know, it pops. One of the challenges of being online and in the virtual world is to keeping up with the technology. We're just now rebuilding the whole site, bringing in a whole new architecture because everything's changing so quickly. If you don't rebuild your site every few years, year behind.
Do you find the new digital landscape very competitive?
Oh, my goodness. You can't believe how many sites are out there, particularly when it comes to food and drink. And it's an interesting time because the barrier to entry is very low. Anyone can have a blog. Anyone can throw together a collection of blogs. But what we're seeing now is that for 5 years or so, when there's been so many new entrants coming into the market, they were very much downscale. The vast majority of the sites are trying to deliver easy recipes for moms staying at home and cooking, not trying to tax anybody too much. We've sort of gone the other tack and saying, you know what, we're really interested in the more complex stories about food history, food culture, what's new in restaurants, what's happening with chefs. And so we stuck our flag on the more ambitious side. And it's been fun because we've kind of had it to ourselves.
What do you see as the advantages and then conversely the disadvantages of online media?
Oh, I love the immediacy. I love the fact that we can do something quickly. We live in a virtual world. My editors work from offices and homes around the country. All the contributors are far flung. We never see each other. Yet we're in constant communication. We're in constant contact. We're able to work really efficiently as an organization. And yet when we want to get together, we can Skype, we can talk on the phone, we email constantly. The fun of being able to connect people with similar backgrounds and similar professional interests around the world, and they connect with each other and they share ideas with each other, and there's a community of professional writers and food authorities that now operate in this nice online world.
Well, as a writer, I want to thank you so much for this inspiring platform that you've created for us all. So thank you, Corey.
Thank you, Bobby.
Corey Brown, co-founder and general manager of Zester Daily. When it comes to social media, here's what Brett Anderson has to say about Twitter.
I don't consider tweeting, which I do, to be writing. It's a way of gathering information, and it's a way of sharing information that wasn't with us not that long ago. But I don't really consider that stuff to be writing. And I say that as someone who very much respects the world of social media. But I think that's something else.
Whether you love it or hate it, social media has quickly changed the way we stay connected to each other. Twitter alone has over 200 million users, and it's been estimated that over 400 million tweets are sent out from the microblogging platform each day. With all that information being exchanged, there's bound to be some manufactured garbage, but it's just as likely that some tweets are nectar and ambrosia. Kat Kinsman, editor of CNN's blog, Eatocracy, shared this defense for Twitter and social media.
Eatocracy is run by me and by my fantastic colleague, Sarah LaTrent, who has been there the whole time. And we talk to people from all over the country and say, what's happening in your area? What do you love to eat? People find us online. They find us on Twitter. And we just have conversations with as many people as we possibly can. Food is a big and beautiful thing. And I've realized along the way that you can talk with absolutely anybody in the world about food. Everybody eats.
It is the universal language. And now, Kat, one of the things that you are the most adept at, more than really almost anybody I know in media, is social media. And I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about your experience in social media, what works for you, and how it's changed your world and the world of food.
It's undeniable the power of social media these days. And I know a lot of people like to write it off as, you know, at Twitter especially, as being silly about just sort of broadcasting what you're doing throughout the day. A lot of the people who I follow on social media are farmers and chefs, and they're giving insight into the process of how the food comes onto your plate or comes into your store. And you're just getting these little windows into places you would otherwise never get to see, whether it's coming from a fishing boat, from a field. There's this one farmer, Brian Scott, who I follow very avidly. I was watching today on social media as he was posting pictures as he was harvesting from a soybean field. And these things are going to end up on somebody's plates. And it's a great way to know exactly who the hands are that have touched what you're eating. I know if I go to a different city where I've never been before and I say, hey, Twitter, feed me. And I started a hashtag at one point, Twitter, feed me, and just saying, like, I'm near this particular corner. Tell me where to go. And people are really generous with their information, and they want to show the best of their city. So they'll say, you should go there, you should go there. One of the best experiences I ever had with that, I was in Providence, Rhode Island, and I was there for a sad reason. My uncle had passed away, and I was going to the funeral the next day. And I just needed to have a quiet dinner out by myself and, you know, somewhere near my hotel. And I asked people, if you were going to be in Providence, you know, for a solo dinner, where would you go? I ended up going to this great place called Two Rivers. And I was sitting there at the bar, ordered my food, and this other plate sort of came out. And I thought, oh, you know, maybe they gave this to me by mistake. And they said, well, the chef knew that you were having a hard time and you were here for a sad reason, and he just wanted to make your day a little better. And it was, I started crying there at the bar because it was somebody I'd never met before. And he wanted to reach out with just a gift of food. And that happened because of social media. And that's just one of my favorite stories ever.
Which is your favorite platform these days?
I love Twitter because you can bring together a whole lot of different forces. You can share pictures directly from Instagram, which I especially love because you have a visual on things. Yesterday, I was out on a swamp tour and took a little 16-second video of just the boat going down the swamp. And that way, I was able to just bring people along on my journey as I was doing that. And you can wrap a whole lot into Twitter now that you can include video and pictures there. And it's spontaneous. It's quick. You can follow and unfollow people. It's not a huge commitment, and it's right there in your pocket at all times.
You can find more information about Kat Kinsman through her Twitter handle at @kittenwithawhip or by visiting eatocracy.cnn.com. Or tweet me. I'm @PoppyT, and I'd love to hear from you. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. For this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we'll approach eating from a botanist's point of view with Deborah Madison.
I come from a family of botanists, so, you know, plants have long been on my mind. And I also became aware of farmers at the market mislabeling produce and making our real knowledge of it sort of obscure or hard to obtain. And I thought, why don't we know a little bit more about them? It makes it a whole lot more fun.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakaman Lady Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.